One of the goals of this event was to promote interfaith dialogue on the University of Alberta campus, and to that extent, we have also arranged for an interfaith panel discussion. So I would like to invite the panelists up here to the front and to take a seat here, and I will introduce them. Our first panelist is Rabbi David Kunin. David Kunin graduated from Brandeis University with a degree in medieval history. He then attended the Jewish Theological Seminary of America, where he was ordained as a rabbi and received a master's degree in Judaic studies. He is now the rabbi of Beth Shalom Synagogue in Edmonton and also the Jewish chaplain at the University of Alberta. He speaks widely on Jewish topics as diverse as halakha. Is that how you pronounce that, David? And the modern Jew, crypto-Judaism in Spanish America. He also speaks on issues of understanding between different religions and traditions. So, David, we're very happy that you are here with us. I would also like to introduce Carola Radler. Carola is a German lawyer who has served as a judge in Frankfurt, Germany. After previously articling law firms in Frankfurt, Germany and Sydney, Australia, and with the State Ministry of Education of Hesse, Germany. Is that correct? Hesse? After her immigration to Canada, she first fulfilled her childhood dream of building up a quarter horse breeding and training business, while at the same time caring for her family. And in her perpetual interest of pursuing questions of eternal importance, she is currently engaged in completing her Master's of Theological Studies with honors at St. Stephen's at the U of A. Her particular focus is in relation to religion and law with a view to ecumenical, interfaith, international, and multicultural issues. So, Carola, we're very happy that you're here with us as well. And finally, I'd like to invite Dr. Ibrahim Abu Rabi. Dr. Abu Rabi is the ECMC Chair in Islamic Studies in the Department of History and Classics at the University of Alberta. He did his PhD in Islamic Studies at the Temple University in Philadelphia, and his interests lie in interfaith dialogue, contemporary thoughts or movements, and in mysticism. So we are very happy that you are here with us as well. So the way this is going to go is each panelist has been invited to speak for about 15 minutes, and I'm going to ask them to come up to the podium to do this. They will simply go through. Carol is going to go first, David Kunin will be second, and Ibrahim will be third. Following their discussions, David Goa again will come up and moderate a discussion which will be open to all of us. And again, if you're a King student, please don't hesitate to speak up. This is your opportunity, and we're going to show you special treatment here. We have this space for longer than 2:30, so you can come and go as you please, but don't think that we're constrained by time, so feel free to speak up at the end. So, Carola, thank you.
First of all, I would like to thank David Goar and everyone who organized this forum here for inviting me to join this panel. I approach this topic, education on evangelism, from a legal German constitutional history perspective. In April 1940, Willem Wissert-Hooft, the secretary-general-elect of the newly formed World Council of Churches, based in Geneva, described in a letter to colleagues in England and the U.S. Nazism and communism as anti-Christian forces determined to wipe out Christianity altogether. He wrote, "In this situation, the Church dare not concentrate its main attention on what are commonly called peace aims, but must rather confront in a wholly new manner that hardest of all tasks which it has faced since the times of the early Middle Ages, namely the reconversion of most of the Western world. This is a tremendous spiritual and missionary task rather than a task of technical and political character." It does not come as a surprise, then, that in the wake of the military operations in 1945, many Christian missionaries, evangelists, as well as mainline denominations, came via Geneva to Germany. But contrary to this, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, a Lutheran pastor and professor of theology at the University of Berlin, envisioned in 1941 a post-war secular and pluralist society in Germany with a generally emancipated worldly church and mutually recognized and balanced limits for the state-church relation. So whose vision unfolded in post-war Germany? After heated deliberations within the Parliamentary Council of 1948-49, the representatives of the political parties, the Catholic Church, and the Evangelical Church of Germany, the new German constitution, the Basic Law, as it is called, was accepted. The Evangelical Church of Germany should not be confused with fundamentalist or evangelist notions. It is the mainline Protestant church in Germany of Lutheran and Calvinist tradition. Within the 1949 constitution, the Basic Law, freedom of faith, religion, conscience, and the right to profess a religion, religious or non-religious worldview, confession, including their practice, as well as the freedom to assemble in groups and associations, are guaranteed. Also guaranteed is state-supervised education with religious instructions, which are organized in coordination with the religious organizations, and the parents having the right to decide about their children's attendance. Further, the Constitution prescribes that there is no state church, and all religious and worldview associations have equal access to a public law status which is connected to financial state support. The religious freedom, assembly, and education rights are part of the human and civil rights catalog at the of the Basic Law, where they enjoy a very particular protection. The catalog is binding for all state powers as immediately, directly applicable law. Any person who feels violated in one or more of the basic rights has guaranteed direct access to the German courts, including the Constitutional Court. And an additional safety net is given in the so-called Eternity Guarantee. Amendments to this catalog are inadmissible. They are, so to say, untouchable. Contrasting this, the no state church prescription and the public law opportunity regulations are found in regulations of the 1919 Weimar Constitution, which are accepted as immediate parts of the current basic law. So why do religious freedom and religious education enjoy a special protection? And why could regulations of an earlier constitution find their way unaltered into the 1949 basic law? Well, during the 19th century Germany, the idea of a secular state wrestled with the idea of a Christian state. Catholicism discovered during the 19th century what the liberal bourgeois and political demands for individual freedom rights offered for the church. It brought the possibility to replace the customary ties of the church to the monarchic state with an independent church safeguarded by basic freedom rights. Catholic representatives of the Constitutional Assembly in the wake of the 1848 March Revolution seem to have accomplished this political Catholic program when no state church was proclaimed. Also, freedom of faith and confession, the right to freely assemble and to found associations, were to be claimable individual rights and immediately binding for the state powers. But this Frankfurt Paulskirchen Constitution, as it was called, proved to be way ahead of its times. Instead of coming into effect, it took a 100-year detour through a Kulturkampf, which is an English culture war, as well as another revolution and a totalitarian dictatorship. The detour began with Bismarck's Kulturkampf in the 1870s, which he waged against the political Catholicism of the Parliamentary Center Party. The Center Party, whose influence cut across class and provincial lines, had become the strongest party in the parliament of the newly established German Reich of 1871. Bismarck, a Pietist Lutheran Prussian conservative statesman, was convinced that the center's party spirit stood in allegiance to an authority in Rome, which was foreign to the parliamentary German state. That is, basically, was a state within a state. His conviction was fueled by the recently proclaimed papal ban curse, which condemned 80 liberal errors, like individual religious freedom, state-regulated schools as well, and it was also fueled by the Vatican's declaration of the dogma of papal infallibility and the dogma of primal jurisdiction of the Pope, which guaranteed a so far unknown absolute and worldwide power. In a country like Prussia, where an eight-year mandatory school attendance had been introduced in the 18th century and fully implemented by the 19th century, Bismarck intended to subdue the influence of the Catholic Church within society in general by attacking their involvement in the educational system in particular. He succeeded in submitting church-operated schools to state supervision, banning Catholic priests from office in public schools, monitoring clergy education and employment, omitting the financial state support for Roman Catholic episcopates and clerics, imprisoning clerics, and much more. But the culture war, which had aimed at destructing the parliamentary influence of the center party, was clearly lost, as instead of weakening the party, it actually gained strength in subsequent parliamentary elections. But the culture war has left a permanent legacy: the reduction of ecclesiastic worldly jurisdiction and the requirement to respect state law, the revocation of ecclesiastic school supervision and state-supervised universities. In contrast, the evangelical Protestant Church, true to its Reformation tradition, had remained during the 19th century in close relation to the state. The sovereign of a territory had a summus episcopalis, also dominion over the external ecclesiastic affairs and the internal affairs of dogma and liturgy of the Protestant Church. After World War I and the monarchy-ending revolution of 1918, the radical socialist communist left immediately proceeded to install a republican state church by attacking the position of both churches within society. In this situation, the moderate socialist democratic party and the Catholic Center Party reached with the 1919 Weimar Constitution an amazing culture compromise. The declaration that there was to be no state church brought the millennial cut of a prohibition to reintroduce any legal forms of state church system. Thus, it provided the normative fact of the end of the Christian state. It was the legal end of the bond between throne and altar. This radical separation of a state church prohibition would have meant to reduce the Protestant churches to the private civil law level. This blow, though, was softened with a status under corporate public law for all religious societies, a status which was attached to self-determined internal legislative powers, the applicability of favorable taxation laws, exemptions from employment laws, protection from expropriation, financial support for church buildings, and more. This limping separation, this limping secularity, as it's called, is an arbitrational, peaceful settlement in which the freedom and independence of all involved is balanced with an equal offer to all religious societies to receive state-backed opportunities. It provided, actually, the lifeline for the Protestant Church, which, by gaining the legal autonomy to ecclesiastic self-determination in all external and internal affairs, had at the same time through its separation from the state apparatus, lost its whole financial base. In its mindset, though, the Protestant Church remained in close proximity to the state until the 1940s. Then the National Socialists attacked both churches by targeting confessional schools and religious education in public schools, theological faculties, the church's financial order, and their public law status. Their purpose was to depoliticize the churches and to deconfessionalize public life. The Protestant Church became, by way of the German Christians, almost a Reich Church. But recalling in the church struggle of the confessing church their nature, the Protestant Church finally realized the necessity to fully accept independent responsibility. By 1949, both churches had finally gained the inner strength to approach the state, generally emancipated with a consciousness of independence and self-reliance. But also the state had gained a distance towards organized religious worldviews. The combined learning of all parties involved through centuries of war and revolution has produced, with a basic law, a system which today protects the hard-fought for basic rights of religious freedom and a state education system with religious components, in full knowledge of the radical separation existing in the US, France, and the Soviet Union. The Parliamentary Council of 1949 opted with a great majority for this historically grown pluralist and balanced framework of institutional and organizational separation with regulated continued cooperation instead of a radical separation with exceptions. By 2004, approximately two-thirds of the German population belonged evenly distributed to the two major churches, but from those, only about half actually described themselves as religious. Most of the remaining one-third are not attached to any confession or religion at all. They mainly reject the dogmas of the confessional faith and prefer an individual patchwork kind of private faith. But their value system is not much different from those connected to organized religion, and it also is carried by family and friends. 3.9% of the German population are Muslims, and 1.9% belong to other religions or Christian confessions, which includes the evangelist movements. For Germany, as a committed member of the EU, the all-European reality is also decisive. To the individual European, the most important European topic is peace, with an overwhelming 52%, followed by respect for human life and human rights, while religion features with only 7%, and only 3% understands religion as a representative value for the European Union. Although there are differences between the member countries, Germany features in all the topics on the average mark. So during the past two centuries, two extremes, a Christian extreme and a political extreme, had triggered wars, a culture war and a military war. Both extremes used education and church finances as fronts in their battle between faith and politics. In contemporary Germany, neither war talk, like the Samuel Huntington's culture war kind, nor evangelist Christian state mentalities, nor leadership talk as used in the US election process, resonate within most of the German population. It invokes visions of conflict, not peace, and touches too closely on the still living memory of charismatic Führer talk that used and abused religion. Not conflict-oriented or fundamentalist evangelism, but actually practiced peace, supported by balanced political solutions, was in post-war Germany on the people's mind and still is today the directive in Germany. Today, Germany guarantees the freedom to profess or to abstain from professing a religious or non-religious worldview confession, as well as affordable state-supervised and funded education on all levels with incorporated religious education in cooperation with all relevant religious institutions. Thanks.
Before I start, I'd like to actually throw my cards on the table that I'm a blue state liberal. And that colors my view and essentially my acceptance of what you would call the extremist American accommodation of religion, or the, at least I would say, the ideal separation of church and state as embraced by the American Constitution. I find that comforting, although I don't find it a reality. After all, every American political candidate always ends their speeches with a cheer, rousing, and may God bless America, it's really. And Elizabeth Dole, not terribly long ago, ran ads against her, the person running against her for Senate seat in Carolina, saying that she was an atheist. Oh, my God. So it actually lends credence to me when I was reading Richard Dawkins' book, and he was talking about how atheists are persecuted in the United States, and I'm beginning to see maybe there's a reality there. It worries me because whether you have a religion or you embrace any religion or no religion, hopefully our countries and our political systems are embracing enough to allow all of us to live comfortably and have equal rights and be able to participate equally in the political process. Now, equally, I had an argument not terribly long ago when I was at synagogue with a congregant, and we were discussing the American political system again, and not perhaps surprisingly considering how it's so embracing and encompassing everywhere we look, we hear about it, and we see what's going on down in the States. And this person was very upset because they said religion should have no place in politics, meaning for her, not that a bishop should be saying vote against this person, but instead that a political candidate had no right to use his or her political religious framework to shape who they were and how they and the political views they expressed. And I felt this was nonsense since, we'll go to worldview again, we are created by our worldviews, whether we like it or not, and they're going to shape how we look at every kind of political decision we make. And it's right that if we have a religious faith that shapes who we are and creates our sense of values and morals, that it affects who we are. And we can't help it, and we wouldn't be whole people if we didn't admit it. We wouldn't be honest, probably, if we didn't admit it either. So, that being said, religion is there, it's part of the political process, because people are religious or not religious, have worldviews of a variety of types. But what is the role that religion, and I come from a Jewish perspective, should be playing in the political process? And I have about 13 minutes left to address that, which is a daunting task. Now, let me also put my cards on the table in another sense. Though I am called a conservative rabbi, it's definitely a conservative with a small c, from my religious perspective, and not within any kind of conservative world religious view, even within the whole movement. It's a very small c, almost to vanishing. And I don't represent the entirety of the Jewish world, whether from the left, where there are movements further to the left than I am, or to the right, so much so that the kind of worldview where religion should be very, very involved in politics is definitely present within Judaism, and so much to the same extent of the evangelical-type movement within the Christian world, you have the extreme religious point of view within the Jewish world as well, that very narrow view you were talking about, not the intellectual expressions that are reshaping the evangelical world, and I'm not sure they're reshaping the Jewish extreme right yet. But there, I was hearing about congregants who were down in Florida for a wedding, and the rabbi and other people from this very Hasidic synagogue where this wedding was taking place were going around during the service telling everybody vote for a certain political candidate, who will remain nameless, though his though his running mate's from Alaska. I always hated when people did that, you know, I got a chance to do it. It was great. So where does the Jewish worldview come for the separation of religion and politics
Can I fit it in within a Jewish worldview? And I want to start back at the beginning because the Jewish worldview has been shaped, and my worldview has been shaped really by Jewish history, but also in how I look at the role of religion and theocracy almost within Israel, where I see the very strong power of religion within the Israeli political system as one of the greatest detriments and one of the great issues that Israel has to focus if it's going to emerge and become a truly democratic country in the 21st century. I see a challenge for Israel because there you have a set of official religions, sort of like the compromise you were almost describing. But so you have the official Jewish, you have the official Muslim, and actually I think they embrace all the different forms of Islam. And then there are a few official Christianities, and everybody else it gets in trouble, especially the Jews. Because we're the majority in Israel, and therefore we get persecuted the most, at least within the religious system, in that if you are not Orthodox within Israel, you're in a lot of trouble. Your conversions don't count, your weddings don't count, you can't do funerals, you can't be involved in the religious arbitrational processes. So it is indeed a very serious problem, and it creates issues where the Orthodox parties, especially within the political process, are able to exert a huge amount of influence on the government, extending to peace issues, extending to issues of economics, almost everything, education, because of the enormous amount of political power that they, as minority parties within the political system, wield. And I see a danger of this kind of process where religion is so involved within politics, and that shapes who I am and my perspective. But my perspective also is shaped by Jewish history. And if we go back to the beginning, of course, we see a very theocratic system, at least the idealized within the biblical text, of Moses being both the civil leader and also the religious leader, although you already have a separation to some extent with Aaron taking on the high priesthood. But then as the ancient Israelite state develops, you continue to have this a tension and at least the beginnings of a separation. You already have a monarchy, a very weak priesthood in the biblical period, and then you have a countercultural voice of the prophets speaking from the outside, trying to influence politics while not directly taking part within the political system. Albeit I suspect that the religious voice and the religious absolutism of the ancient Israelite tradition was probably there, that if you were preaching something that went against the Israelite tradition in ancient Israel, you're probably in real trouble, as you probably were in medieval Europe or even post-medieval Europe as well, or in other parts of the world even today. So, but there was at least beginnings of a separation, which becomes really embraced within the rabbinic period. The rabbis critiquing the Hasmonean period of Jewish history, which was a period where you had a rebellion against the Greeks and then the establishment of a semi-independent Jewish polity ruled by someone who was simultaneously high priest and king, was condemned by the rabbis. And in fact, the rabbis said that the reason why the Hasmoneans died off was because they embraced priesthood and kingship simultaneously. If they had taken one but not the other, it would have been fine, but taking both led to an illegitimate form of government. Now, the rabbis were saying this already at a time when they didn't really have terribly much political power. They were living in a Roman world where the Roman government controlled most of the civil authority, all of the capital authority over the criminal courts, and therefore the rabbis were speaking and they had really control only over the religious. But their system, the halacha, embraced everything. It embraced everything from civil to religious law. So they were simultaneously looking at this kind of world where they thought Jewish law was all-encompassing because in Judaism there wasn't an easy divide between the world of religion and the world of the secular. Everything was embraced. But they also were looking at a reality where there was a separation between government and the imposition of power of government and the religious authority that they wielded. And they already began to reshape their Jewish values to say, how can we as a religious society exist within a civil society, and where does religious law end and civil law begin, and where does, if one contradicts the other, who do we follow? And they came up with two concepts. One was dina malchuta dina, which means the law of the land is the law, meaning when we live in the Roman world, when we live in medieval France, when we live wherever, we have to follow the laws of that particular country. And obviously, largely because they had no choice, because if you didn't, the Roman government would kill you, or the medieval French government would, whatever you want. They would kill you for a lot of other reasons as well, but if you broke the laws, certainly they would. So Dina Malchuta, Dina, was one concept that allowed for Judaism to coexist and for them to really reconcile religion and state. And the other was a concept of royal authority, based on the idea, looking back at an idealized picture of the Bible, that you had these kings who were separate from priests and prophets who wielded royal authority and created an ideal, although we don't have any evidence of it, set of laws that ruled, that really were the basis of how they ruled their kingdom, which wasn't necessarily identical with the halakhic sources or religious sources that the rabbis taught. So you had these two concepts, and the rabbis then, looking at the world in which they lived, felt comfortable to say, yes, we can follow Roman law because of Dina Malchuta Dina, and we can say it's contradictory to ours because this is royal law rather than law of the particular religious tradition or the law of the rabbis. And of course, the rabbis looking at the world, and I think it's an important understanding that to say that any religion should be that which exerts control or is the religion of the state is a dangerous idea, and it's not surprising that Judaism came up with that realization, because Jews lived in a predominant Islamic world where they were seen as second-class citizens, or a predominant Christian world where they were seen as second-class citizens and often persecuted, and this would certainly color their world view, as religion being in power and being supported by state was not necessarily a healthy way of being, something I'm afraid they didn't learn when they created the state of Israel. Having said that, there's an interesting midrash, or rather commentary, on the story of the Tower of Babel by a commentator named Sfarno. He looks at the Tower of Babel and he questions, what is the reason why the people were punished and God scattered them across the globe? And his commentary coming 300 years ago was that because the people of that time wanted to impose a single religion on everyone, therefore God scattered the people across the globe. So already they were condemning this idea of one state religion supported that was forced on everyone, but rather looking at an idea where different people could embrace different religious traditions within a single polity and be able to live in peace. Obviously an idea that I embrace and that our Western societies, at least to some extent, ideally embrace. And I see I have about 3 minutes left, which really means I have to rush. So Judaism came into the Western world as citizens not until the 19th century and only at the time of Napoleon. And at that time, when they came in and they became full citizens of France, or able finally to be full citizens of France, Napoleon questioned them and said, you have to give up your self-rule. You have to give up those things that separate you and prevent you from being full French citizens. And if you do so, then we will indeed allow you to be citizens of France. And the rabbis at that time gathered in an event called the Great Sanhedrin in Paris. And essentially they quoted the two ideas that I've talked about previously, Dina Malchuta Dina and the royal authority, as the basis of Jews entering into the modern world and embracing modern Western liberal values. I guess it's hard to connect Napoleon with liberal, but at least in this respect, I think it's valid. Now, I have about 3 minutes, and I want to talk a little bit about where I see religion and religion's role in the political process. I don't go around my congregation telling everybody to vote for you-know-who. And of course they can't vote anyway, so it's not a problem. Nor do I think it's appropriate for a rabbi, a bishop, an imam, or any religious leader to say, vote for this political party. But I do think it's our job to represent our views, our worldviews, whatever they are, that shape us as human beings and give us our moral sense within the political process. If we don't, we're being dishonest to ourselves. So I think we need to be true to ourselves and our religious values, and I think that religion has to free itself from being tempted to be so closely entwined with any political party or state, and instead to look at ourselves as voices from the wilderness. Karl Marx, in looking at religion, critiqued religion as the opiate of the masses, because he said religion has the tendency to allow people to feel comfortable within the status quo, especially because if you're going to go somewhere in the next life, or if the world's about to come to the end, you don't need to change anything now, and therefore you vote Republican. Or, I think that that's a danger that religion faces. When we support political parties, when we become so connected with the state that we become official state religions, or even being tempted to do so, or look at the state and fail to raise our voices, then we are part of the opiate of the masses. Then we are indeed part of maintaining the status quo, preventing change. But when, within all of our religious traditions, we're courageous enough to speak for our voices and make sure our voices are heard within the political process based on who we are, based on all of our variety of traditions, being voices from the wilderness for change, for improving the world as best we can in all our different ways, then I think religion's at its best. Now, let me sum up by saying, therefore, when someone comes because of their religious tradition and is anti-abortion, I embrace that as a legitimate point of view. When someone comes and says, I'm pro-abortion, I embrace that based on their religious tradition. Or I think our primary goal is to feed the poor. All of these voices need to be heard as part of the diverse voices of our democratic process. And it's only when we embrace the legitimacy of all these voices and try not to speak so loud that we drown them out, then our political processes are stronger and religion is a healthy part of our human society and a healthy part of allowing our societies to grow and develop into the 21st century. Thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi. As you well know, my name is Abu Rabbi. In Arabic, it is Abu Rabir. So the son had to go first. First of all, I'd like to thank both Rick and David for this kind of invitation. And I'd like to thank Molly also for her inspiring talk, which reminds me of a major classic in American political theology, Richard Hofstadter's book, Anti-Intellectualism in American Life, that came out in the 1960s or so. In terms of faith and politics in Islam, anyone could talk about different levels of faith and politics in Islam. One could talk about what the Quran has to say about politics and faith, and there is a very, very comprehensive discussion of that relationship between politics or state and religion in the Quran. Or one may talk about what classical Islamic theologians, Islam has been there for at least 1400 years, what classical Muslim theologians have had to say about faith and politics. And in that vein, we can talk about what the Sunnah theologians had to say about the relationship between politics and faith, or what Shiites have had to say. But I'm not going to talk about the Quran or the classical theological scene in Islam. I'd like to talk about certain examples from the present-day Muslim world, the contemporary Muslim world, and speak about different models of the relationship between faith and politics in the contemporary Muslim world by talking about four different Muslim countries in broad generalizations about Indonesia, Iran, Pakistan, and Turkey. And I hope that there will be some discussion to discuss all of these significant ideas that we've heard today. Now, I think that if we take the prime example, that of Iran, that's the only example that we have in modern and contemporary Islamic history where Muslim clergy are in power, where the ulama or religious leadership are in power. That's the only example that we have in contemporary Islamic history. And we might argue that the example of Iraq in the wake of the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq has placed Shiite clergy in power in Iraq. But this has come after the U.S. occupation. To my mind, it's not natural, whereas it has been somewhat natural in the Iranian case, where the ulama, or the clergy, made a revolt against the Shah and secularism and installed a Shiite theological or theistic state. That's the only example that we have. The second major example, which is somewhat different, is the example of Indonesia. Indonesia, as you might know, became independent in 1945. And when the Constitution of Indonesia was drafted, the Constitution talks about five major principles that are called, in Bahasa Indonesian, Pancasila. And the first major principle is nationalism, the second is social justice, democracy, internationalism. But there is one significant principle, theism. That's to say that Indonesia is based on theism, but not on Sharia. That's to say that Indonesia is not an Islamic state, although most of the population of Indonesia are Muslim, around 85% or so. Indonesia is not an Islamic state because it is not based on Islamic Sharia, but it is based on theism. That's to say that every citizen of Indonesia has to have a god of his or her own. And that's why, according to the Indonesian constitution, there are five different religions, and Islam is only one of them. So that's a theistic example, and that's the only model that I can see in the contemporary Muslim world of theism in Indonesia. The third major example is that of Pakistan, and Pakistan is very similar to Israel. That's to say that when Israel was established, it was established in the context of, first of all, the Holocaust, but second of all, in the immediate context of the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people in what we call Israel-Palestine. Pakistan was established in the context of violence, that's to say in the midst of killing of millions of Sikh, Hindu and Muslims, especially in the Punjab area, which is split halfway between India and Pakistan nowadays. But anyway, Pakistan has claimed from the beginning to be an Islamic country, and there had been an Islamic constitution. Officially it's called the Islamic Republic of Pakistan, but in terms of practice, it has been the military elites who have been in power in Pakistan since its own creation in 1947, since the partition of India and Pakistan. And the military elite, by and large, except the last one of Musharraf, by and large claims to be religious in public, but secular and sometimes atheistic in private. And this has been the case with almost every military elite in the Muslim world and perhaps the non-Muslim world. The last example and the last model of the relationship between faith and politics is that of Turkey. And the Turkish situation is very, very complex, because the founders of modern Turkey, Kemal Atatürk and his comrades in the 1920s, aimed at creating a highly secular regime, radical secular regime, where religion is expelled from the public sphere. And religion has been controlled. Religious institutions in Turkey have been controlled by the state. As you well know, in Turkey, you cannot teach Islam, because most of the Turks are Muslims. You cannot teach Islam outside of the preview of the state. That's to say, you cannot teach Islam in a private seminary or college. It's illegal according to the Turkish constitution. But Kemalism, that's to say, the legacy of the westernized secular elite that founded the modern Turkish state in the 1920s. Kemalism failed 10, 20 years ago, and nowadays what we have in power is a Turkish Islamist party. It's called in Turkish AKP, the Justice and Development Party, and this party has come from the womb of the Refah Party, the original Islamist party founded in Turkey in the 1960s. That's to say that, in a sense, we have two major centers of power in Turkey. The one is the Kemalist. It is nowadays embodied in the army, and that's the hidden state, so to speak, in Turkey. And the second is the AKP party, which is Islamist in nature. And in a sense, there has been a rapprochement or compromise between these two different centers of power, but they might collide anytime soon because of the situation at the domestic level as well as the external level, especially vis-a-vis Iraq and the Kurdish situation in Iraq as well as in Turkey. And therefore, when we talk about the relationship between faith and politics in the contemporary Muslim world, where do we go? What do we do? I believe that we have to speak about different sets of what we call elites in the contemporary Muslim world. The first major elite is the religious elite, the position and the status of religious elite in contemporary Muslim societies. The second is military elites, and the military elites have been in power for a long time. And the third is the nationalist elites, That's to say, those elites who have established a nation state, such as in Indonesia, Pakistan, Turkey, and even Iran. And the fourth that we must not forget is the tribal elites, especially in the Gulf states. And in a sense, all of these elites have had different positions on the relationship between faith and politics. And let me highlight for a second the position of the tribal elites in the Gulf states. You know, many people would come and say, well, Saudi Arabia is the center of Islam because the holy cities of Mecca and Medina are in Saudi Arabia. When people, especially Sunnis and Shiites, when they do a pilgrimage, they do that to Mecca and Medina in Saudi Arabia. And that's why Saudi Arabia is the center of Islam. It's the most authentic Islamic example. But I think that from a political science perspective, and most of you are in political science, there is no doubt that Saudi Arabia for the past 220 years or so has been ruled by a tribal elite that is secular in nature and that has allied itself to foreign powers, initially the British and later on the Americans after the 1940s, and it is still supported by the American power in the area. And if you remember, according to the official American story, 18 out of the 20 hijackers in 9/11 had come from Saudi Arabia, but Saudi Arabia was not attacked by the USA. It was Iraq that had nothing to do with 9/11 that had been attacked. So that tells you about the power and perhaps the perseverance of tribalism in the Gulf states and outside of the Gulf states, and the way tribalism has taken advantage of religion, in this case Islam, in order to preserve its own status and its own longevity. To an extent that lots of Muslim and Arab authors in the 1970s have begun to talk about what they call petrodollar Islam in Arabia. That's to say that the function of petrodollar Islam has been to preserve the economic and social foundations of tribalism. That is a very significant feature, not only of the Gulf, but of a country like Jordan, of a country like Syria, because it has been the same family, the same tribe, ruling since 1970, of a country like Iraq under Saddam Hussein. It had been the Baathists, who had come from a small village in Tikrit, who had been in power. Of a country like Morocco, the same royal family, which has been in power since the 16th century. So tribalism is a major feature in contemporary Islamic politics, but above all, it has been very much connected to the international political system and very much supported by the center, that's to say by the West, especially by Europe and the USA, which means that it has never been, to my mind, and we can argue that point, it has never been in the interest of the USA and the West to spread democracy and human rights in the Muslim world, but it has always been in the interest of the USA to preserve, support, and nurture tribalism and dictatorship in that part of the world. Now, last point that I'd like to make, which is that nowadays there's so much talk in the West, not only by the media, but also in the academic community about what we call political Islam or Islamic fundamentalism or radical Islam. I mean, we heard about Al-Qaeda. We began to hear about Al-Qaeda 10 years ago, about Bin Laden, Zawahiri, Taliban, and this and that. Now, therefore, the question is, what is political Islam and the relationship between political Islam and the current regimes in the Arab and the Muslim worlds? This is a very significant question. I think that, by and large, you know, one could talk about political Islam in the 19th century, but the present-day phenomenon of political Islam goes back to the 1950s, to the 1940s and 50s in the Muslim world, when the nation-state was established. What we see nowadays as a triumph of political Islam or resurgence of political Islam has been a direct result of two major factors, it seems to me. The first major factor has been the breakdown of nationalism and the failure of the nation state to deliver on its promises of modernity and modernization in modern and contemporary Arab and Muslim societies. And the second major reason for the rise of Islamism or political Islam has been the fact that tribalism and the retribalization of Arab society especially has been or have been a significant factor in modern Islamic and Arab politics. And therefore, Islamic fundamentalism or political Islam has been a reaction to the breakdown of the nation state and a reaction to the nurturing by the center, European and American center, of tribal dictatorship, especially in the Arab states and most specifically in the Gulf states. And if one talks about, briefly, political Islam, it has had so many different features. One of them is that it has been an urban middle-class Islamic phenomenon emerging in different Islamic cities, in Egypt, in Algeria, in Tunisia, in the Sudan, in Pakistan. In Pakistan, we have a major Islamist movement by the name of Jamaat al-Islami. In Indonesia, all of these movements have been urban Islamist middle-class movements that have been very much disappointed by the current political status quo in the Muslim world. The second major factor is, or feature of political Islam, is that political Islam has been pan-Islamist in nature. That's to say, it has not been confined to a particular country, but it has had a global image from the very beginning, at the head of which is the re-establishment or the reinstitution of the Islamic Caliphate in the final analysis. That's to say that, by and large, perhaps you could argue, political Islam believes in a clash of civilizations between Islam and the West. Political Islam sees the West as being responsible for the major malaise, the comprehensive malaise and stagnation in contemporary Islamic, in contemporary Arab and Muslim countries. And therefore, the way to get rid of that malaise is perhaps to have a major fight against that imperialist, dictatorial, and neo-colonialist West. And finally, I would like just to quote from one of the major Islamists, the Egyptian Islamist Yusuf Qaradawi, who resides in Qatar, and who recently, in the past 2 weeks or so, has created a major controversy in the Arab world by attacking the Shiites and Shiism, and by saying that the Shiites are active in converting the Sunnites into Shiism, and that they have to be fooled, they are not true Muslims, this and that. But 20 years ago or so, Qaradawi wrote a major book, and we have an English translation of that book by the title of Islamic Awakening Between Rejection and Extremism, where he talks about the awakening of Muslim youth in the Muslim world in the 1980s. And in a sense, he blames the Muslim ulama or the Muslim clergy because they did not take care of that phenomenon. He says, quote, "Our own hypocrisy as ulama and religious leaders and self-contradictions have alienated the young in the Muslim world, the young who have sought to understand Islam without any assistance or guidance from us." And that will bring me to my final point, which is that the phenomenon of somebody like bin Laden, as a young person growing in Saudi Arabia, studying engineering and not theology, in a major university in Jeddah, Western Saudi Arabia, this person grew up without any guidance or assistance from the clergy because he saw the clergy to be allied to the state and he saw the clergy to be highly pacifist, that's to say lending theological ammunition to the state against the young people. And this is perhaps one major reason for the rise or re-rise of fundamentalism and extremism in the Islamist movement that is fully represented by people like Ayman Zawahiri or bin Laden or the Taliban phenomenon. Thank you.
A remarkable set of presentations in a remarkable amount of time. Thank you so much. I'm not sure whether there's enough for you to think about here. It does feel a little bit like trying to swim in four oceans at the same time. But I'm going to do two things. One is, first of all, invite each of our speakers, if there is a particular idea or theme or issue that they would like to take up for a few moments with one of their colleagues, and then I'll open it up to the rest of you, giving a little bit of a preferential option for, it's a Vatican, Second Vatican Council idea, a preferential option for the students initially, and then for all the rest of us. So, is there something you, Rabbi?
Yeah, I was struck by Abraham's discussion at the end of the origin of. I thought I had a loud enough voice. Of the origin of the Islamic extremists from the lack of education or the resistance to seek education by younger people because of the complicity they see in their religious leaders. And what struck me was that if we look at the rise in the Jewish tradition of people moving towards the more extremist models, we see exactly that, where they look at the more moderate religious leaders as not providing the answers, or at least the easy answers that solve the problems of the modern world. They want black and white, pretty much. And therefore, they look at the more extreme models or look to their own studies. And I think that therefore, it comes to the same thing. And I think it's striking. I don't know in the Christian world if that's similar. It sounds like people are moving in other directions, but yeah.
Do you want to speak, Molly, to the, or at least what has struck me, as an earlier form of the evangelical tradition being quite shy of the liberal arts for a period of time? And what you're investigating is the recovery of that. I'm just thinking of this image of engineering. There is no engineering taught here at King's. Bin Laden studied engineering.
Yes.
That is, there is a form of strong religion which at times eschews its own history and its own theological history and is focused very narrowly and is afraid, in fact, of the deep sources of its own tradition. And what I find so interesting in your explanation is that you're seeing this kind of attempt to recover something from it.
One thing I can say that I think applies to all forms of fundamentalism, no matter what the religious tradition, is that fundamentalists are modernists. They are creatures of the modern era. And they are modernists insofar as they are often brilliant, if sometimes unconsciously so, at selectively recovering aspects of their heritage and warping aspects of history as it is convenient to them. And they are reacting very much to modern phenomena and to mindsets and the dominance of a certain kind of rational thinking, the rise of the nation state, which are very peculiar to the modern era. Certainly, as far as American evangelicals are concerned, they alienated themselves partly by choice, largely by choice, from the mainstream intellectual life, from the academy, because they saw it as the source of the most undermining acids that were threatening the core of their religion, which they viewed as this very narrow understanding of biblical authority. And that has waned in some cases by deliberate strategy, as I outlined in the cases of changes that have happened at some of these schools. But largely they have, I think, become more mainstream, and it's been a practical and a mindset shift in general. And this sense that to be intellectual is in some way to be a traitor to the faith is an attitude that has faded, I think. And evangelical identity and the ability to sort of draw on different resources to shape that identity has become more complex. One question I had that I think touches on all of the panelists' presentations, but particularly Carola, is the relationship between religion and national identity, religion and patriotism, I guess, for lack of a better word, which is often a very touchy issue in many different contexts. I'm speaking from a position of woeful ignorance when it comes to German culture, but I spent about a month in Berlin toward the end of the last World Cup, and I was struck by the level of patriotism, German patriotism, in the guise of support for the soccer team that I saw there. My understanding has been that since World War II, patriotism has been a very problematic issue for German citizens. It's been kind of a taboo in some sense. But in my conversations with German young people, students in Berlin, my perception was that this is beginning to change, that this new generation is not quite as constrained by the legacy of World War II and is more exuberant, exploring their German identity in different ways. My question for you is whether or not this is true, and to what extent, if any, religion plays any role in that new conception of German identity.
Those are quite a few questions. First of all, the overall understanding of the German state and the constitution is that it's a framework, a roof over all kinds of different worldviews, religions, denominations, and that the state has the duty to allow them all, but also keep the peace between them all. So, and that is accomplished mainly by the Constitutional Court. So the highest court is from case to case. If somebody thinks he's injured in some kind of way in one of the basic rights, can go straight to the Constitutional Court, and in every single particular case they will find the balance. It's a very balanced system. Always the balance between the interests to keep the peace. So the nationalism, well, and patriotism. Yes, with the young people, they are removed from what happened in the first half of the 20th century. But they still, that they grew up in this kind of framework, that everything, every idea is permitted, and we can talk to each other freely, openly, and everything, whatever we want to say in the public arena. When you see now in the World Cup the flags coming up again, and this is more a feeling of freedom. Yes, we can. We are not Germany, we are European. We are one part, a particular part of Europe.
But they're not flying
EU flags. No. But each single country within the EU flies its flag, and so does Germany. It's just one part of the whole EU. And I wouldn't call it patriotism, because patriotism has always a negative ring to it because of the 20th century. And it's also not nationalism in this sense. It's a pride of being part of Europe, a peaceful Europe, where Germany was a major part in creating this peaceful, peaceful Europe. Actually, if you think of it, since the Roman Empire, the old Roman Empire, 2,000 years ago, this period since the Second World War is the longest peace period in Europe, in Central Europe. The longest one was during the Roman Empire. It was about a stretch of 100 years. Now we have more than 60 years of peace in Central Europe. That is quite an accomplishment. And Germany was one of the driving forces and will be. I mean, nothing is ever perfect. You have to keep on working at it. But when the flags come up, this is just of we are part of this peace system, Europe. This is how I understand it.
I have a question for Ibrahim. I know in the ultra-Orthodox Jewish world, there is, while people do go to university, generally they do study engineering. No, it's truth that within the Hasidic and ultra-Orthodox Jewish world, while they may attend secular universities, they almost never will major in the liberal arts. They'll major in the hard sciences, which for Judaism are not terribly problematic religiously, or they'll major in computer sciences or one of the or similar types of fields or medicine. But they almost never will be in the liberal arts, precisely for what I think David was talking about, as it's a challenge to their faith, and the whole Western tradition is seen as dangerous and not a nurturing way of nurturing faith. So I was wondering if in the more extreme forms of Islam, say in Iran, where fundamentalistic type of Islam essentially controls the country, are people encouraged, or do they avoid the liberal arts and move more towards the more, I guess you'd call it, practical parts of the university world?
And if I could just ask you, just put a footnote to that. I know that you have recently published a book on Nursi and done work on other modern Muslim thinkers who have established their own educational
bailiwicks. Could you weave that into it?
Yes, yes. I mean, Iran is a very interesting case. Iran, I would not, you know, Najad might be radical himself, but there are many moderate forces in Iran. Iran is perhaps, I've never been to Iran myself, is perhaps the most democratic Islamic country in the world because they have a parliament, they debate, they have Armenians and Jews in the parliament. That's not the case in a country like Saudi Arabia. It is like in Egypt. If there's a parliament in Egypt, I have no idea. Sheikh Zayed is here. But it is true that most leaders of the Islamist movement in the Muslim world have come from hard sciences, from that background. They have not studied the social sciences or the arts, the liberal arts. And this is somewhat strange. You know, even at the University of Alberta, the Muslim Student Association, the MSA, it might have like 400 to 500 Muslim students, most of whom study hard sciences. And they don't study philosophy or religious studies or history or American history or literature, which is very strange. But that tells you about the emerging Muslim middle classes that parents usually encourage their kids to study sciences, especially medicine, business and law, and not social sciences and the humanities. And I know a great number of Islamist leaders in the Muslim world who have studied engineering. I mean, not only bin Laden, he's the only one case, but there are lots of other cases too.
Zohairi is an MD.
The Lubavitch Rebbe also studied
engineering. Right.
Zohairi is an MD.
And Zawahir is a medical doctor, that's true, I mean, from Ain Shams University in Cairo. Now, in terms of Nursi that David mentioned, Badir Zaman Said Nursi is a Turkish theologian who died in 1960. And he established a major movement in Turkey and outside of Turkey. Many of them, many of his followers are Turks in Germany as well, by the name of the Nurju or the Nur movement. And there are like 4 to 5 million Nurjus in the world. And basically he's apolitical, he's pacifist in nature, and he's concerned about the preservation of Islamic faith in the high age of radical secularism, that's what he calls it. And to him, the 20th century, he died in 1960, as I said, the 20th century is a symbol of the high age of radical secularism.
Abbas, if I could conclude this lecture,
yes.
Say this. Western backing to Arab and Muslim dictators, which kept them in power, this led to the alliance with the clergymen so that they stay in power.
Yes.
That lead to the creation of Islamic extremism? Did I say that?
Could you repeat it, please, Ibrahim?
Western backing to Arab dictators, which kept them in power and which led to their alliance with the clergyman and the religious leader, which didn't teach the youth, as you said, about Qardawi. Did that lead to the Islamic terrorism?
Yes. I believe that in the current Arab world, if we just confine ourselves to the Arab world, especially in the Gulf states, there is no space of democracy in those states at all. There is no political democracy, no elections, no freedom of expression. Most of the mass media has to follow the line of the status quo. And that has led to a major alienation of the educated youth in these societies. And these societies, these tribes, have built many universities. And they graduated many students, men and women, who have become alienated with the current status quo, with the political system, and the lack of political and intellectual freedoms in the Arab world. And some of them have resorted to what we call Islamic extremism. If you look at, you know, Sheikh Zayed mentioned Ayman Zawahiri, bin Laden. These are highly educated young Islamists. And their followers are highly educated young Islamists as well, who had come from different parts of the Muslim world to support Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan or Pakistan, whatever. But most of them are highly educated. So the educated Islamists have been extremely alienated by the political status quo, and some of them have resorted to Islamist violence as a way to express their anger and dissatisfaction with the situation.
Does that speak to your point? Were you also asking a little bit about the connection to colonialism?
Yeah, so we can please say, conclude that Western backing and colonialism...
Yes, yes. I think that,
how's most, that
most of these regimes are supported by the international political system, especially about the USA and Western Europe. And that's why when my friend speaks about peace in Europe, that's very good. But there's the other side, that Europe after World War II decided in a unanimous way to export violence to the Third World. We cannot talk about peace only in Europe, because there have been extreme consequences of this type of peace after World War II. And one of them is the fact that if you look at the permanent military industry, that's to say those who produce weapons of mass destruction, most of them are based in Western Europe, in North America, as well as in Israel.
Please.
I studied at Calvin College in the United States during a time when the evangelical group became increasingly influential in American politics. President Bush even spoke at our commencement in 2005. And now my team studying Canadian politics and trying to figure out the Canadian system. I was wondering if you could comment on any of the observations comparing your various perspectives on Jewish, American, Islamic, European system to how religious worldviews are received in the Canadian political system.
Well, that could be done quite briefly, I should think.
I'm also not from here, so it's the only thing I could say, looking from the outside as an American coming to Canada and trying to contrast the role that religion, especially the Jewish state, Jewish tradition plays within Canadian politics as opposed to American, is I find that the Canadian Jewish population is quite a bit more diffident than in the American system, and therefore the Jewish community plays a far more active role within the American political process.
Molly, do you want to say a little bit about how you'll talk about this tonight a bit? And maybe you could just say a little bit about that or respond. Do
my,
an ad.
Sure. My talk this evening is about how it is the case that religion has become so intertwined with American political culture. And by way of kind of contrasting with the Canadian case, try to explain how it is that two countries that are so similar in many ways and share much in their heritage have gone along such different trajectories. It's a very complicated issue. I won't get into the history right now. It would take me down roads that would occupy all of our time. I will say just briefly that it seems to me there are many similarities in how Canadian evangelicals ally themselves politically compared to America, particularly in the province of Alberta. But I think the flavor of conservatism, and David, you and I have talked about this a bit, to which they ally themselves often is a bit different. There's a stronger libertarian streak in Canadian conservatism that is less and less true in America. There certainly are libertarians in America, but so it's more complicated in Canada in some sense because very conservative religion is not terribly compatible with a libertarian view of government necessarily, or it you have to do some thinking about it because you cannot, if you're a libertarian, you cannot impose your moral social values on your fellow citizens. And so I've attended conferences held by an organization in the United States called the Intercollegiate Studies Institute, which was founded by William F. Buckley, a Roman Catholic. And it's become kind of a libertarian organization, but all the people who go to its conferences are evangelicals and Catholics. And so they get very, they just end up in a tizzy because they cannot really get on board with much of the, you know, Friedrich Hayek and some of the great libertarian sources. And so in the States, there's a more comfortable relationship, at least there has been for the past couple of decades, between conservative Christianity and a big government version of conservative secular politics. And generally speaking, I think there's a dispositional difference, and this is a hard thing to put your finger on. It's not just that Canadians find the God bless America at the end of American speeches to be vulgar. You know, many of you got all worked up when Harper did that a couple of times, God bless Canada, because it sounded so American, made you wince. But I think, too, that Canadians are just more understated in general, and they don't have as visceral debates or believe that they have the right to inquire into their fellow citizens' deepest beliefs, secular or religious. Maybe it's because it's colder up here, you know, and you're more buttoned up. But it's not just religion. I mean, there's a personality difference that informs all of this. And if you want to know more about the history of it, you should come to my talk this evening.
Indeed.
Don't we really need each faith community, let's just say in Canada, each faith community to start seriously working at its own public philosophy, its own way of answering how we live together, and then coming together out of each of these communities to shape a common compromise, rather than thinking one tradition brings it in or another tradition brings it in, but encourage all faith communities to think about what their public philosophy should be. What is what should the role of the state be? You said, you know, it wasn't compatible with what evangelicals actually believe to have a libertarian view of the state. Amen. I haven't thought about public philosophy. I've served on the Evangelical Fellowship of Canada Social Action Commission. And, you know, they begin to think about it, but they haven't done a lot of thinking about it. Each faith tradition needs to do that and then come together and say, this is how we will compromise and work together and accommodate each other for the long term. And we have deep reasons for coming.
Well, I'll just say very briefly that, spoken like a good Kuiperian, I mean, there's a reason that so many American evangelicals who can't even spell Abraham Kuyper's name will nevertheless quote him and his famous saying that, you know, there is no square inch of this world on which Jesus Christ does not, you know, slam his foot down and say mine or whatever the line is, because Kuyper and the Reform tradition within the Christian world has done more thinking than most about this. And so a lot of evangelicals are adopting, to the degree that they know what they're saying, a Reformed cultural theology.
Well, that, and that side, but not the public philosophy side.
No, that's true.
Principle of public moralism.
They think that Kuyper lost his nerve on that and his willingness to tolerate.
Well, that's organic to his whole thing.
Absolutely. They don't understand Kuyper. They quote him all the time, but they don't get him.
Abraham, you chuckled around that question.
Yes. I mean, I am new in Canada, but I was thinking about the Muslim communities here in Canada in the plural, because we don't have one unified or homogeneous Muslim community here. And it seems to me that the major challenge facing the Muslim communities is that it will take them, I don't know how many years, but some time to know about each other and to accept each other in a non-Islamic context, such as the Canadian context. For example, there's a debate within a Muslim community here in Edmonton. Do we accept, let's say, the Ismailis as part of the Muslim community or not? Or worse, the Ahmadi community that originated in India in the 19th century? Or the Bohra community, which is a small Shiite community within India? Are they part of the Muslim community or not? So these are some of the problems facing the Muslim faith communities here in North America. And another major problem is the problem that we talked about before, is that we don't have public Muslim theologians who are part and parcel of Canadian society or American society, who can reflect on the one hand on Islamic faith on the one hand, and on what the new generation of Muslims face in a North American context on the other hand. Let's say in matters of education or in matters of whatever marriages or what, you know, all of these issues that face the Muslim communities here in North America.
Bruce.
Yeah, I have a question. President Bush's promotion of faith support, government financing of faith-based community organizations, really financing churches in their involvement in social action, I guess. The evangelicals in general have supported that. Does this raise questions about separation of church and state? What will become of that whole program as if the election produces a Democrat in the White House? And I'm really interested in this question from the point of view of Alberta, because I know the evangelical community has approached Premier Stelmach and tried to get him involved in a similar setting up a program here of actual direct support to churches that are involved in helping in poverty and so on. And I think that would really, really detrimentally go against the tradition here. Now, we're, it was interesting your question and how you.
Well, in the Canadian case, there's far more precedent for direct formal relationship between church and state. I mean, the educational system is one example of that. And so, you know, Canada has more...
Yeah, but still, the Catholic social, those institutions are still a bit arms length from actual church. You know, I respect the funding of Christian schools, for example, but Christian schools, again, are arms length from actual churches. But not the states.
Well, I'm not sure how closely you've been following Barack Obama's speeches, but he's very much, he's spoken a lot about faith-based initiatives, and that's a large part of his platform. So if he is elected, they will be probably a more centrally integrated element of his general attitude toward increasing American service than they were under the Bush administration. Evangelicals were very disappointed, by and large. They felt that under the Bush administration, faith-based initiatives were sort of shunted off to the side and given kind of marginal status, while so many promises were made about the degree to which they would be involved in policy. And so Obama made a very both strategically wise and, I think, from a policy standpoint, wise move by placing them so centrally. Because it's a way of bringing the church and conservative evangelicals into a healthier relationship with the state.
It's clear that Bush used that connection in the last election and maybe the election before that.
Well, listen, I don't think, I'm no Bush fan, but I think that the cynicism about him is of limited usefulness. The fact of the matter is that any president or leader of any country faces a myriad of challenges, and what they promise up front is always going to be very different from what they're actually able to do. And I think if you look at how the landscape changed after Bush got elected, particularly in the wake of 9/11, it was only natural that faith-based initiatives would have to lose their place in his list of priorities, I think. And this view that so many evangelicals had, that he was one of them and not a politician. He was just an evangelical that might sit next to them in the pew on Sunday who happened to be commander-in-chief, was a very silly one, because all politicians have got to be pragmatists at some level. So, you know, I think that the evangelical criticism is valid on this point, but perhaps a little bit naive.
But Bruce, I think, is coming at this from another angle.
Well, I just think that there's
a real fear about it.
Right, a fear of this. I mean, this seems to me diametrically going against the separation of church and state. I don't know why the more liberal segment of America isn't really trying to shoot this down.
Well, what does separation of church and state actually mean? I mean, this is a very contested question in America, and it has been throughout American history. And if you're asking, you know, does it mean a threat to the degree to which religion is walled off in one's private consciousness, that's never been the case in America. Yes, formally speaking, we've never had an established state church. Yes, you know, the Bill of Rights protects freedom of religious expression, but always it has been true that our political culture has been deeply informed by religion. So, to some extent, I think that the Canadian model of formalizing some of these relationships and perhaps being more honest about them and regulating them more has led to a more secular society in the end. So if that's your goal, then I think perhaps it's worth considering that a more formal relationship, one that does bring the churches into direct conversation with the government, while that needs to be mediated and carefully, you know, laid out, doesn't mean theocracy, is my point.
It's a huge issue in Canadian politics because, a party in the Ontario election actually lost big time because they wanted to have more direct connections between government funding and private schools and so on. So this is a huge issue that we all face right across the country. That's amazing.
Ibrahim, did you want to step into that?
No. There's a question here. Let's give it.
My question regards is Molly, and I'm wondering if you see amongst these different trends in contemporary evangelicalism possibly a resurgence of a sort of political quietism on account of disappointment in Bush, because of this idea he's one of our own and all we got was two good judges and a lot of other mess, right? That what was promised was delivered, therefore, well, that was our attempt to do politics, let's get out of it entirely. Some of, like, I think Cal Thomas and some of these other big evangelical writers started saying that more explicitly, that this was our experiment, we didn't get what we wanted anyway, so...
Right, it's a great question because it would be a very reasonable response. A recent articulation of not political quietism, but some of the criticisms you're suggesting came in the form of a document that was circulated called the Evangelical Manifesto, which was a rather long treatise issued online and in some material form signed by a number of the most prominent leaders of the evangelical community, particularly suburban megachurches, which are major cultural forces in America. And the basic point of it was we evangelicals have allowed the Bible to be co-opted by politicians. We've been turned into the tools of a particular brand of political thinking, and we need to reclaim our identity aside from politics. This statement made not much of a splash, as far as I could say. And I came in touch with some interesting responses to it, particularly from evangelicals or people who perhaps share the same theological position who felt left out, namely black priests and pastors. I spoke to one evangelical black pastor in Washington State who was furious about the Evangelical Manifesto. He said he called the authors of it a bunch of evangelifish with no spiritual spines. And his position was, for black Americans, it is a nonsensical statement to say religion and politics should be separate. The black church, for as long as there's been a black church in America, was the one politically safe venue in America where black Americans had any degree of control over their own communities. And it played an integral role, of course, in the social revolutions of the 1960s and has always been politically very important for black Americans. And so there was a lot of resistance from those few black Americans who paid any attention because most don't really think of themselves as evangelical. In America, evangelical is still kind of a white word. And so this complicates things when you're trying to talk about who's in that community. But so as a general statement, though, I'm not encountering a lot of quietism, perhaps because there are viable political options that have presented themselves, because Obama has done the best job of any Democratic candidate in recent memory, Jimmy Carter perhaps being the last one, who really seemed genuinely religious in any sense of the term. I mean, evangelicals certainly are, you know, they're not going to him in droves, but he's made it an option for them in the way that previous candidates didn't. So I'm sure, there's always going to be to some degree a kind of isolationist response, but it hasn't been a massive one as far as I can tell.
That's satisfactory.
Yeah, I just don't want to drag this too long, but to simplify this, what would be your advice to the young Canadian generation that is coming up when it comes to religion versus politics to run this, in particular Canada, in the future? Because we seem to have, we are seeing a generation that's simply tuning themselves up to one or the other. Some young generation are going towards religion, and that's where you're going. Some are going towards politics, and some are going towards nowhere. So what's your individual advice to the young generation that's coming out in this future, the 21st century? How they would handle this?
Just a very systematic answer here from me. Well, really define what you understand under secularity and separation of church and state. Because I hear a total confusion here of the concepts. This would be my advice. Just start at really defining what you really mean. And don't just go in this direction off or in that direction and then combine the two concepts, but nobody really knows what the other one is talking about. Separation of church and state, this is what totally confused me when I first came to Canada and when I'm here in North America. Separation of church and state. Over there, they are constantly talking in religious language, but are saying we are totally separated. So this makes no sense to me.
Yeah, well, in terms of separation of church and state, I grew up somewhere else where the translation of this term is completely different.
This is what I mean.
Like, if I translate what I grew up with, this term is that homeland is for everybody, religion is for God. That's actually the actual translation for that same concept. So, and I believe that.
Mm-hmm.
But now, living here in Canada, there's a whole generation that's coming up, does not know where are things. And you have talked, collectively, you have talked about history, about Europe, about the States, about Indonesia, about Iran, but let's bring it to Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And the young people that are listening to you talking.
Well, one of the things you could do is, of course, have them come to school here at the King's University College and study with John, Professor Heemstra, and then there would be some clarity. Great Neo-Kyperian clarity. Rabbi, did you want to? Oh, I'm sorry, Carol.
Just one last thing. What you had just said is exactly what I mean. What are we exactly talking about? And each one of us has a different kind of definition for these terms.
And
yeah, it's obviously not that easy.
I think that's the truth, that it's not easy, and we live in a multi-religious ethnic society where there are lots of voices, and someone was talking about trying to find a compromise between them. I don't know that that's something I would want to aim for. Instead, I would want each of us to be embrace a principled relativism where we respect each other and respect the multiple voices that form our society and allow a democratic process to continue because we hear all of the different voices, embracing our whole selves, whether it's atheist, whether it's Jewish, Christian, Muslim, or whatever our identity is, speaking with our voices but being part of a process where we respect each other.
Abraham?
You know, just a little brief response. Comment. If we take two different models, the Canadian model of the relationship between religion and state, and the Pakistani model. It's like in Pakistan today, there's a major collision, not only between Islamists and the state, but between Muslims and the state. And this is mainly because the state has been confused about its own identity since partition, since 1947. The state has claimed to be Islamic in nature, but it has been secular in terms of the leadership. But that type of confusion, it seems to me, does not exist here or in North America or in Europe, especially in the past century or so. And as you well know, in the Muslim world, in the past 50 years or so, most of the religious institutions have been built by the state and they have been controlled by the state. I think that in the Muslim world, this is the only world where I hear that we have, in almost every Muslim country, a ministry of Islamic affairs or religious affairs. And the ministry is in charge of different institutions, of the endowment system, of religious education, all of that. We don't have private seminars in the Muslim world in the same way that we have it here. We have them here in Canada or North America. So the state is in full control, although the state is not religious.
Richard? And we'll conclude, I think, with you.
There's kind of an interesting phenomenon here in Canada, whereas evangelicalism has had a history, at least in the distant past, of anti-intellectualism. The government here, more recently, has had a history of anti-religionism. But this is changing, and a good example is the University of Toronto. In our university here, you know, there's been a big debate recently about expunging the term God from the charge given to graduates. You know, use your degree for the glory of God and the honor of your country. It's funny, nobody has a problem with honor of your country, which might get you into more trouble. But anyway, one of the examples cited was the University of Toronto, where they have no such charge. But the University of Toronto just invested $1.5 million in creating a gorgeous multi-faith space and hired a full-time director and a full-time program coordinator
on the public dime. These are public dollars. And one of the things they say in their website is that the spirituality, the diverse spirituality of students at the University of Toronto, is an opportunity for education that should not be wasted. Okay, they're seeing it as a resource. And furthermore, they're saying that the marginalization of spirituality will alienate students. So what's happening is that the public institutions, while on the one hand sort of expunging God from the charge, the graduates, and so on and so forth, the public institutions are taking a role in creating friendly spaces across where these theological divides are overcome by the creation of a multi-faith space funded by public dollars. So this is a really, it's kind of a, like, to me it's almost like, at first I thought, this is kind of schizophrenic. You know, you get rid of God in the chart, but on the other hand, it follows kind of a trajectory in the Canadian way of dealing with religion. And that is that now it's almost like they've decided that, well, gosh, this is a resource, and you know, we shouldn't not acknowledge it. We need to see this as an opportunity to educate. Anyway, what's your take on that? Because it just seems to be.
I thought that was funded by the Ismaili community at the university. That's what I heard, and not by public money.
It's public money.
Ah, I see.
It's tax dollars. In fact, the very humanist club here that you know is mm-hmm. is seeking the expunging of God. It was over their objections that this went ahead.
Well, what's happening in Toronto sounds to me exactly like the German constitution. Public money is creating a space for everyone to talk under and finding solutions to live together.
I think it's great.
I would like... Oh, sorry.
Sorry, I think we'll leverage the expunging of God from the charge.
Right, to a space.
This other thing.
Good, yeah. Just before I call on my colleague Rick Van Menen to thank our guests, I wanted to mention again that Molly Worthen will be speaking this evening on the title Jesus for President, exploring some of the questions that were asked a little bit earlier, and that's going to be at 7 o'clock at the TELUS Center, and I think we will be all leaving there, certainly by 8:30, just in time to see what has happened in our neighbor to the south. And I want to leave you with a line that I've thought of a number of times over the last couple of days from the great American Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who on one occasion, if I recall it correctly, said that the truth of conservatism is that culture is the source for a healthy society. And the truth of politics, of the liberal position, is that politics may, not necessarily, but may save culture from itself. Would you like to thank our guests?
Yes, I'd like to thank, David Goa and the Chester Ronning Center, as well as the U of A Political Science Department for their generous support of this forum, and also the Religious Studies Department at the U of A and the Faculty of Arts for their willingness to support us with publicity. But especially, I would like to thank Molly and the panelists for your willingness to speak to us. So let's thank them together. And finally, to Steve Martin, John Heemstra, Julianne's not here, but and the King's University College for allowing us to be here with you today. So, and we'll see you tonight.